Chapter 13. Terra, the Imperial Palace. Joscina Tull had a view of the fields of winged victory from her quarters. The armour glass window stretched across the entire width of the reception chamber. The room was the largest of her suite, occupying half of the top floor of the Pharos Tower. The size was not an indulgence, nor was its collection of tapestries that draped the opposite wall. This display, drawn from holdings of works from across the Imperium, changed daily. A necessary ritual. The furniture underwent a similar change. There was always a large dining table and seats for dozens. It was the individual identities of the items that altered. Sometimes Tull took an active part in the selections of the day. Sometimes she left it to the serfs. What was important was the display. Any guest would see the riches of imperial trade and the vast reach of the Chartist fleet. Repeat guests witnessed ever greater wealth through perpetual variety. The more important the visitors, the more often they came, and the more they would be dizzied by the unending parade. The symbolic, Tull understood, was not weaker than the real. The symbolic shaped the real. In the right hands, it was a weapon. Some of the other High Lords grasped the principle. Mesring certainly did, but his view was blinkered. He couldn't see beyond the icons. He could only understand symbols that derived their potency through connection to the God Emperor. Then there was Lansung, a hopeless case. He could see the symbolic value in military action. He couldn't imagine the reverse.
"Gazing upon your good work?" the Lord High Admiral asked.
Tull turned away from the window. She nodded at Georg Steinert, her major domo. He withdrew. "I was," she said to Lansung.
"Proud of yourself, aren't you?"
"Proud of us all. This is a great moment." He snorted.
"Well, you can enjoy it without me."
"What do you mean?"
"I won't have any part of the deployment."
"The Autocephalax Eternal?"
"It will remain on station."
"You realize what that will look like?" She was pleased that she answered without pause, as if his decision made no difference. Perhaps it didn't.
"Yes."
The exhaustion in that single syllable was immense. At some point, Lansung appeared to have crossed the line between humiliation and apathy.
"You're a coward,"
Tull said, making sure Lansung understood what was heading his way.
"I'm not here to posture," he said.
"I know you're not. I'm telling you simple truths. If you back out of the Proletarian Crusade, I'll destroy you."
"Threats now?"
"Just the truth, like I said." Lansung shrugged.
"Threats," he repeated. "Empty ones."
"Is that a dare?" she asked. He shook his head.
"Just the truth, since that's what we're speaking. You won't destroy me. The orcs will take care of that when they arrive. I'll outlive your fleet of fools, though. I notice that you're not accompanying them."
"I'm not a military commander."
"No, you most certainly are not."
She smiled. "I sense there is a point you're making, Admiral." He gave her a hard, tired stare.
"I've already made it."
He turned to go. "You know I will destroy you," she said. He stopped.
"I know you can, but why? Out of spite?"
"You know me better than that."
"I thought I did."
"You are sabotaging something too important."
"Bold words."
"The truth." He walked to the door.
"As you say. But important to Terra or to you?"
"Get out." She went back to the window. She heard Steinert show Lansung out. She looked towards the fields of winged victory and took a breath. Lansung would have been pleased to see that it was unsteady. He would be wrong to think he had rattled her. She had been bracing to face hard questions when he arrived. No, she wasn't a military commander. She was aware of that. Yet this was a campaign that she had mounted and that she was directing. She had Very Old and Zek on board, but she had to be cautious about using them as resources. She had arranged to have the Astra Militarum regiments spread out through the Armada as a means to provide some structure to the civilian troops. But the move also diluted Very Old's leverage. He, Zek, Mesring, Eckarth, all of the allies in the Crusade had some pull, but only she had control of the Armada itself. The captains answered to her, so she had final say on disposition and launch. and tactics. The plan of attack was not a sophisticated one. Then again, if it was, it couldn't be carried out. The ships were crewed by merchants. There were able pilots aboard many, pilots who had brought their ships through threats as lethal as any faced by the Imperial Navy. Their skills, though, were individual. They had no experience fighting in formation. They fled conflict. They didn't seek it out. She asked herself the question she'd been avoiding since first announcing the Proletarian Crusade. Was she making a mistake? She made herself think through the consequences. She ran through possible balance sheets, measuring investment against risk, potential gain against possible loss. She was oddly reassured. If the crusade failed, political damage would be the least of her problems. Retribution would be far from anyone else's mind. Defeat would mean the loss of everything. Success, however, would place her in an unchallengeable position. That was the equation, then. Victory of the Armada meant her personal victory, while defeat meant no one else would be the victor. There was no question. This was the smart move. It was also so much more than that. She believed in what she was doing. The crowd in the fields was the biggest yet seen. The people there now were not volunteers. The last of those had embarked hours ago. Gathered now were celebrants, well-wishers, families, the excited, the curious, the hopeful, the desperate. They were all the desperate. Tull had given them hope. She had given all of Terra hope. That was a singular achievement. She was proud of it. This was Terra's greatest crisis since the siege, the worst moment in the living memory of every human being on the planet. The plague of despair had been upon them. Zex Adeptus Arbites had been unable to end the panic, and she, with a single speech, had turned the tide. She had given the billions determination, direction, purpose. An endeavour of legend had sprung into being at her urging, and despite the doubts of Angerich and Lansung, it was not a folly. Lack of action would have been a folly. And what other options were there? The cry for help had gone out, but there were no elements of the Navy or the Adeptus Astartes that could reach Terra in time. How do you know? That was the question she could not answer. It kept prying open her doubts. She closed them again with reason. Whatever cause the Orcs had for waiting, they would not wait until help arrived. Tull thought it likely that the Orcs believed they had already won and had the leisure of invading when it best suited them. She walked across the chamber to the door. It was time to head to the Great Chamber. Time for another speech. Time to show the Orcs that they were wrong. Time to launch.
"We're going in on that?" Cord asked.
Their shuttle was drawing up to the Militant Fire's landing bay.
"What did you expect?" said Haas. "A grand cruiser?"
"Of course not. But this, it's so small."
He was right.
"I can see even smaller," she pointed out.
"That makes me feel a lot better."
He craned his head to look up through the viewing block next to his bench. He squirmed in the grav harness.
"I was hoping for maybe one of the mass conveyors."
He pointed to something Haas couldn't see from her angle.
"They'll be carrying thousands."
"Nor room for everyone on them. They're mainly reserved for Imperial Guard companies, from what I heard."
"I know that,"
he said, irritable.
"I was just saying what I'd hoped. Those ships are strong. They can take some hits. This will get swatted in the first seconds of the attack. We're cannon fodder."
"That's a revelation to you?"
He shrugged. He didn't look at her, watching as the shuttle entered the fire's bay. Haas said,
"What did you think was going to happen when we joined this endeavor?"
Another shrug.
"Look at me,"
she said. He did. His jaw was set. There was doubt in his eyes.
"I didn't want to join the crusade," she said. "I thought our duty was to the maintenance of the law and nothing else."
"I'm sorry," he began.
She held up a hand.
"Let me finish. You are right. I was wrong. This is what we're supposed to be doing. If we win, we preserve Terra and the law. If we lose, both are gone. I'm proud to be here, Otmar. You should be too. I don't have any illusions about what's going to happen, though, nor should you. Yes, we're cannon fodder. Of course we are. So is every single member of the Crusade. No exceptions."
The shuttle came to a halt with a bang of landing struts on the deck, the engines cut out. Haas undid her harness and leaned forward.
"That's why
This might work, she said. No one element of the armada is more important than another. It doesn't matter who gets through, as long as enough of us do. She stood up. There's a reason cannon fodder is used. It works.
Gord remained seated. The shuttle's side door opened. Hydraulics hissed as its boarding ramp lowered to the deck. The squad of Jupiter Storm disembarked first. The other 30 passengers followed. Other than Haas and Cord, they were all civilians. Haas wanted to be out in front of them, but Cord was unmoving.
Otmar, she said.
So, glorious deaths await us,
Cord said. He was hoarse. His voice was thin. She clapped him on the shoulder.
Important ones, anyway. Let's go.
His face looked as it did when the Orc moon had become visible over the fields of Winged Victory. Haas had never had cause to question Cord's courage or his dedication to duty. She was dismayed that he was forcing her to do so now.
What's wrong?
She asked. Death had been no stranger in their years of enforcing the Emperor's law. His lips moved. His whisper was too faint.
What?
Haas said. She leaned forward.
It's too big, Cord repeated. We're too small.
She understood him then. She wished she hadn't. He drew his confidence from his faith in the strength of the greater body that he represented. He was a terror on the streets because he felt the might of the Adeptus Arbites behind him. But now, when he acted for the survival of the Imperium itself, he did not believe it was strong enough to defeat the Orcs.
Stand up, she told him.
He obeyed, shame and pleading contorting his features. She stalked out of the shuttle and down the ramp. She was disgusted, but he still wore the uniform of an arbitrator. She would not allow him to disgrace it in her presence. Cord followed her. There were about 500 souls in the cargo bay. Most of them were civilian. There was a scattering of arbitrators from other precincts. Haas counted 3 squads of the Jupiter Storm. They were looking at the people who would be their charges with bemused skepticism. The captain of the Militant Fire appeared on a platform overlooking the bay, flanked by his first mate. He started to speak, but was drowned out by the babble of conversation on the floor. The woman, her bearing marking her as a guard veteran, put 2 fingers in her mouth and whistled for silence.
Thank you, First Officer Kondos, the captain said.
To his human cargo, he said,
Welcome. My name is Leander Narcissus, and I'll have the honor of transporting you into battle.
His manner was easy. He struck Haas as a man who had consciously shed his illusions and was at peace with the reality of his situation. That was a good sign, she thought. He would be less likely to panic under fire. Despite what she had said to Cord, she still liked the idea of some possibility of survival. Narcissus continued,
I am going to wager that a few, just a few of you, were a bit disheartened when you beheld the warlike majesty of the Militant Fire.
He waited for the laughter to subside.
I don't blame you. I would probably feel the same.
He straightened, becoming more formal, his posture almost martial.
Let me say this. We aren't a big ship. Our armor is weak. But we're fast. We're nimble. If you examined the history of the fire by the cold light of rationality, you would have to conclude that she should have been destroyed many times over. Are the odds against us? Absolutely. There is no reason to believe we live one more day.
A sly grin crept over his face,
which is precisely why I say that our odds are excellent.
No laughter this time, only cheers. Haas joined in. She had never expected to take such delight in madness. Beside her, Cord had fallen into the silent misery of sanity. Jaskina Tull, the speaker of the Chartist captains, rose in the great chamber and began to speak. Picked feeds flashed her image and her words across the planet. The speech was one she had labored over since the beginning of the Crusade. She had rehearsed it for days. She knew that its delivery was the most important performance of her life. At an abstract level, she also knew that it might be one of the last. She knew this, but did not believe it. The destruction of Terra and her own death were impossible. She feared the loss of prestige and being beholden to her enemies, but not extermination.
Fellow lords, members of the Senatorum, citizens of Terra, we stand together in a moment of great peril and greater pride. A very short time ago, I asked for your help.
You answered. You answered in such numbers and with such fervour that, did they but deserve it, I would pity the orcs.
That was how she began. She spoke for 15 minutes. She spoke of the bravery of the individual, of the power of the many. She spoke of humility and pride. By the end, she thundered, promising that legendary doom was coming to the orcs. It was a fine speech. It addressed the fears of a populace and sought to calm them. It articulated their hopes and sought to stoke them. It was the greatest work of a politician who knew that oratory was an art form and whose mastery of the medium was unchallenged. Josquina Tull's speech was written to shape the departure of the Armada into an event whose celebration would shake the heavens with its fervour. Was it not, when all was said and done, Terra's last chance for hope? When Tull spoke, her intent was to ignite rapture. Seated on the central dais of the great chamber, Vangarich admired Tull's artistry. Even he was stirred by the words, though their very potency filled him with dread. They were words of enormous meaning. Hearing them meant that the proletarian crusade had begun. Its consequences would be coming soon. Lord High Admiral Lansung heard the speech from the bridge of the Autocephalax Eternal. He had come to his flagship directly from Tull's quarters. He had no intention of being in her sight at her moment of triumph and giving her even more reason to gloat. He was here, too, because of his own dread. He counted Vangarich as an enemy, but the old assassin was right. The crusade would end in disaster. However, as he listened to the speech, he found himself hoping that he was wrong. He had no wish to face the reality of attempting the defense of Terra with just the flagship and its escort. He knew how that would end. With every word Tull spoke, Lansung's throat dried. The conviction grew that he would see his great fear realized. In the fields of Winged Victory, hundreds of thousands watched the picked feed of Tull. They listened with the hunger of the starving. When she finished her speech, and the underbelly of the low, toxic clouds over the Imperial Palace lit up with a fireworks display worthy of the victory at Eleanor, the people roared. The roar was as loud as on the day Tull had announced the crusade, but it was not the same kind of cheer at all. That moment had been the rebirth of hope when all had seemed lost. This moment was when the dream of the crusade became real. The merchant's armada carried all hope with it. It was the last chance. It was the last wall. In the soul of every human on Terra, regardless of belief, was the hard knowledge of how fragile the last wall was. The roar was painful. It made throats ragged. It was the refusal to fall into a final night, and it was the fear that the end was inevitable. It was the holding on to a belief with a fatal, slippery grasp. It was, in a word, desperation. The people cheered, and they kept cheering. Many of them were weeping. Some wished they were on the ships heading for battle, but there was no more room. Others were relieved to be where they were, and cheered because doing so held off, for a little bit longer, the awful experience of waiting that would follow next. The masses in the fields of Winged Victory tried to draw strength from their numbers and from the volume of their shout, but the sky had cleared again towards the end of Tull's speech, and they could see the stars and the lights of the fleet, and they could see the orc moon, and they felt the awful hollowness of hope. So they shouted even louder, shouted until they were hoarse, shouted until they fell to their knees, gagging over the pain of a simple breath. They did not find strength in each other. They saw and heard and felt only their own fear, reflected back at them 100,000 times. They shouted as if that might help them stay afloat in the wave of desperation. But they sank, and they drowned. In the shadow of the Tower of the Hegemon, in the corridors of the administrative complex, larger than a nation state, of the Estates Imperium, in the tangled warrens of the Opifex Hive districts, where the uncountable legions of architects, stonemasons, and other palace artisans dwelt, half a world away, at the base of the Eternity Gate, across the millions of square kilometers of the Imperial Palace, the people stopped in their tasks and their prayers and their tears and listened. On the other side of the globe, in the vastness of the ecclesiarchal palace, they listened. Even in the inquisitorial fortress, Tull was heard and seen. In every corner of Holy Terra, singly or in groups, the people sought comfort in the words and in Tull's magisterial triumphal bearing. Singly or in groups, they came face to face with their desperation. The planet resounded with a cry as fierce, as expressive of the collective pain, as the scream that had greeted the arrival of the Star Fortress. This was not terror, but it was the fear of terror's return. It was the dying patient's clutch at the chimera of a cure. It was the shout that would serve as battle cry for all the billions who would not be in the war until the war came for them. It was desperation. It was sinking. It was drowning. On the thousands of ships that made up the Merchant's Armada, the crews and volunteers and Astra Militarum heard the speech too. They did not pay it quite as much heed. They had other matters to draw their attention. The ships were moving. They were powering up engines. They were leaving anchor. They moved in a rough formation. They were heading into battle. For the volunteers, the reality of their choice had come. Many of them experienced the vertiginous sensation of running off a precipice and feeling the sudden absence of firm ground beneath their feet. Some of them were sick. In the Militant Fire's observation dome, Galatea Haas looked out into the void as vessels beyond counting began to travel in concert. The Orc moon was straight ahead. It was not drawing closer yet. Even so, it seemed larger. She looked at its surface and pictured fighting there. She tried to will the fire past the Orc defences to the commencement of the invasion. Until moonfall, there was no action she could take that would at least give her the illusion of mastery over her fate. For now, she had to wait and place her life in the hands of Narcissus and his crew. There was no sign of Cord. He had barely set foot out of the cargo bay since their arrival. Haas exchanged a look with the soldiers a few paces to her right. They wore the mustard uniform and red sash of the Jupiter Storm. Beneath her armor, so did she. All the crusaders aboard the Militant Fire had been inducted into that regiment. Braylon Gatan was a captain in the 546th Jupiter Storm and the lone officer of that rank on the fire. Beside him was his commissar, Declan Sever, quite a bit older. They nodded to her. They were feeling the same hard impatience. At least she was here, she thought, on this ship. At least she was part of a massive move against the Orcs. She was glad. She had no regrets. Behind her, the speech continued. Tull built to a crescendo of fervor. The ship moved faster, as if it too were responding to her words. The Armada, brought into being by the determination of the speaker for the Chartist captains, gathered momentum. Its formation became more and more defined. It was no longer a confusing cluster of disparate vessels. It took on the shape of a wide spearhead. The ships became the components of the great weapon. "The strength of terror approaches the enemy, carrying dread before it," said Tull. It left dread behind it, too. On Terra, the people knew that many, perhaps most, but by the throne, please not all, of the heroes of the Proletarian Crusade would die. But if those deaths were exchanged for an end to the hellish moon, then they would be celebrated. It was not the deaths that were dreaded. It was their futility. The fleet did not carry dread within it. There was too much determination. But it did carry desperation. Desperation given the shape of metal, given power, given impetus, given speed, but little armor and few weapons, the Armada moved away from its orbital position. The greatest civilian mobilization in Terra's history swept towards the Orcs.